Chapter 1, Trials, Jews, and Nazis. Trials and Doubts. The war crimes trials, which the victors in World War II conducted, mainly of Germans but also of many Japanese, were precedent-shattering in their scope, and in the explicitness of the victorious powers' claims to some sort of legal jurisdiction in respect of laws or understandings, which did not exist at the time they were allegedly broken by the Axis powers. Thus, in disregard of European honor conventions, which had been respected for centuries, German civilian and military prisoners, many of the highest rank, met violent deaths while in Allied captivity as a supposed consequence of these extraordinary proceedings. Nothing resembling the trials of 1945-1949, which were conducted by the wartime enemies of Germany, has ever occurred before. The case of Joan of Arc comes to mind, but that involved a solitary prisoner, not an entire state, and the English who were, in the last analysis, responsible for the trial did everything to make the issue appear to be one of heresy and witchcraft, already formally proscribed, to be decided by an impartial and universal church, according to pre-existing rules of evidence and procedure. In the United States, the real progenitor of the trials, opinion on the appropriateness of having conducted such trials has always been divided, but the balance has varied. In the immediate post-war period, opinion generally favored the trials with, however, some significant voices in opposition. In the middle of the heated election campaign of 1946, just before the major Nazis Goering, Ribbentrop and others were to be hanged, Senator Robert A. Taft delivered a speech attacking both the legal basis for the trials and the sentences which had been imposed. His speech seems to have hurt his Republican Party in those elections. A decade later, views had evidently changed somewhat, since at that time the then-obvious presidential candidate John F. Kennedy published a book, Profiles in Courage, a survey of various people whom Senator Kennedy thought courageous, in which he commended Taft for taking this stand, adding that Taft's views, quote, are shared by a substantial number of American citizens today, unquote. With the Eichmann abduction in 1960 and subsequent trial and with the associated later publicity, opinion seemed to move again, however slowly, toward approval of the trials. Many reasons may be offered for this extraordinary reversal, but it seems to me that, what had happened was that, in a peacetime, generally non-hysterical atmosphere, the world's attention had been focused on one tale of a peculiarly macabre sort, the killing, mainly in gas chambers, of several million Jews, usual figure, 6 million, of all ages and conditions by the Nazis during the war, as part of a program of ridding Europe of Jewry. Gerald Reitlinger's The Final Solution, 2nd edition, 1968, is generally accepted as the most detailed and useful presentation of this claim, and Raoul Hilberg's The Destruction of the European Jews, 1961, tells essentially the same story. Other writings are Nora Levin's The Holocaust, 1968, several books by Leon Poliakov, and The War Against the Jews, 1933-1945, by Lucy S. Davidovich, 1975. Returning to the problem of the appropriateness of the war crimes trials, everybody would agree as to the, at least, shaky legal foundations of the trials, but apparently many people would go along with the claim that the trials were appropriate anyway because normal wartime excesses were not involved. The extraordinary nature of the crime, the extermination of the European Jews, called for extraordinary proceedings. Such cruelty must not only be punished but documented as well, the argument goes. I do not propose in this book to settle the question of what degree of cruelty justifies what degree of legal irregularity. Rather, a rarely heard point, which is at least relevant to the debate, is insisted upon here. It is a fact that without the evidence generated at these trials, there would be no significant evidence that the program of killing Jews ever existed at all. One has only to examine the sources employed by Hilberg and by Reitlinger to see this. If the trials had not been held, a person claiming the existence of the extermination program could not, if challenged, produce any evidence for this, save a few books, not including Hilberg or Reitlinger, whose claims are just as unsupported as his original claim. Thus, the problem that had been involved in deciding whether or not to hold trials on the Jewish extermination aspect was not a simple question of whether or not to try mass murder. Unlike the usual murder case, there was legitimate and very solid doubt that the deed had been committed at all. This may surprise the reader who regards the tale of Jewish extermination as a near certainty, such is simply not the case. There are many considerations supporting this view, and some are so simple that they may surprise the reader even further. The simplest valid reason for being skeptical about the extermination claim is also the simplest conceivable reason. At the end of the war, they were still there. This must be qualified only slightly. Consider a West European observer, who had been familiar with the status of European Jewry prior to the war, making a survey of West European Jewry in, say, late 1946, East European Jewry was out of bounds. He would have found Italian, French, Belgian, and Danish Jewry essentially unscratched, These points will be discussed more fully in later chapters. On the other hand, he would have found that large numbers of Jews, possibly majorities, were missing from Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Czechoslovakia, then accessible from the West. German-Austrian Jewry was confused because, although most had emigrated before the war, it was difficult to be precise about what numbers had emigrated to where. In any case, large numbers, possibly majorities, of those who had remained were no longer resident in their former homes. However, the absences were offset by the obvious fact that displaced persons camps in Germany were full of Jews, a figure of more than 250,000 has been given, and that many European Jews had emigrated to the US or Palestine or elsewhere since the beginning of the war. The facts available to the West European Observer in late 1946 argued very strongly against the extermination claims, which had received such wide publicity during the war and at the recent trial at Nuremberg. The passage of a quarter of a century has, despite superficial developments, gradually strengthened this view of the extermination tale, although for many years there was only one serious writer in the field, the late French geographer Paul Racinier. In 1948, he published a book, Passage de la Ligne, on his experiences as a left-wing political prisoner at Buchenwald, 1943-1945, quote, generally received with sympathy, provoking only muffled and inconclusive gnashings of teeth on a certain side, unquote. Then in 1950, he published Le Mensonge d'Ulysse, The Lie of Ulysses, a critical study of the concentration camp literature, in which he challenged the certainty of the gas chambers, quote, it is yet too early to pronounce a definitive judgment on the gas chambers, unquote. This provoked a violent press campaign, which led ultimately to legal actions, in which author, preface author, and publisher were first acquitted, then found guilty with judgments involving fines, damages, and suspended prison sentence, and finally acquitted again. In 1955, the two books were combined as Le Mensonge d'Ulysse, second edition, in which material increasingly critical of the gas chamber claim had been added. The most common, but not very common edition today is the fifth, referenced here, published in 1961, in which year Racinier also published a short complementary volume, Ulysse trahi par les siens, consisting of three essays showing that he had moved rather strongly in the direction of a negative judgment on the gas chambers. The last essay is the text of a speech given in several German and Austrian cities in the early spring of 1960, just before the Eichmann affair. In 1962 followed Le véritable procès Eichmann, the real Eichmann trial, a study of the entire range of alleged German crimes in their historical and political contexts. By this time, he had reached a definitive conclusion on the tale of extermination of the Jews, quote, a historic lie, the most tragic and the most macabre imposture of all time, unquote. Racinier employed two basic approaches to reach this conclusion, the material and the demographic. By the material approach, we mean the analysis of the evidence that mass executions of Jews by gassings or other specific means were in fact conducted by the Germans during World War II. The material approach is nearly synonymous with analysis of the war crimes trials evidence, or of the trials evidence as interpreted by Hilberg and by Reitlinger, and is supplemented by them with similar evidence. Racinier only tentatively explored the demographic approach in Le véritable procès Eichmann, but in his final general work on the Jewish extermination problem, Le drame des Juifs européens, The Drama of the European Jews, 1964, he presented a lengthy analysis of the question from a demographic point of view. In 1965, he published L'Opération Vicaire, a critique of Rolf Hochhut's play The Deputy. One must comment that it is necessary to check up on Racinier in his interpretation of sources, some do not check out, and, in addition, he employs some clearly unreliable sources at a few points. There are also some glaring but relatively irrelevant errors of fact, such as characterizing Hanson Baldwin as the New York Times quote expert in matters of Jewish population, unquote. It is doubtful that the Times ever had a staff member who could be characterized thus, and in asserting that the majority of American Jews are anti-Zionist and support the outlook of the anti-Zionist American Council for Judaism, which was never a politically significant organization. However, Racinier was a courageous pioneer in an ignored area and, despite the various shortcomings of his work, no fair-minded person could read it without becoming at least skeptical about the exterminations. Racinier passed away in July 1967. His books had appeared in German, Spanish, and Italian translations, but no English translation was published for some years. Racinier's books were followed by three books, which Joseph Ginzburg published under the pseudonym J.G. Berg, Schuld und Schicksal, Guilt and Fate, 1962, Sündenböcke, Scapegoats, 1967, and NS Verbrechen, National Socialist Crimes, 1968. Ginzburg's books are not particularly well-researched, since his views are based mainly on what he had read in the newspapers plus his personal experiences as a Jew who, together with his family, was deported during the war to occupied Eastern Territory by the Nazis and the Romanians. After the war, Ginzburg took his family to Israel, but he eventually became very anti-Zionist and moved back to Europe, eventually setting up a bookbindery in Munich. While he believes that many Jews perished as a result of the combined effects of Nazi policies and wartime conditions, he denies that the German government ever contemplated the extermination of the Jews of Europe, and he is particularly scornful of the 6 million figure. He is unsure of the existence of gas chambers, but he believes that many Jews perished on account of epidemics, pogroms, air raids, and executions of partisans, and offers an estimate of about 3 million as the maximum possible number of victims, although he believes the correct figure is much lower. As a reward for his efforts to get at the truth, Ginzburg, a small man and not young, was beaten up by Jewish thugs while visiting his wife's grave in the Israelite cemetery in Munich. Editor's note: in this context, the 7-volume work Die Geschichte der Verfemmung Deutschlands, The History of Germany's Defamation, by the Vienna author Franz J. Scheidel ought to be mentioned, which was self-published in 1967-68. It was disseminated only in small numbers and is not widely known today even among revisionists. The work has a wide scope reaching from atrocity propaganda during World War I, Volume 1, to the injustice done to Germany and the German people after World War II, Volumes 6 and 7. Especially Volumes 3 to 5 tackle the Orthodox Holocaust narrative head-on. A large part of Scheidel's work consists of quotes from more or less revisionist writings which appeared earlier. It offers only little new material based on the author's own research. Scheidel is moreover rather polemical at times and does not cite his sources properly in all cases. The value of this work lies primarily in its encyclopedic presentation of revisionist knowledge as it existed in the mid-1960s. In 1969, a short book was published in the United States, The Myth of the 6 Million, attributed to an anonymous author. While some things can be said in favor of this book, for example I learned of Rassenyer there, it also contains so many errors of fact that it illustrates that it is not enough that a book's thesis be correct, for quite a few people who used it as a basis for prosecuting public controversy got burned as a result. The next development was the publication in Germany of a book by Emil Eretz, Hexeneinmalleins einer Lüge, The Witch's Multiplication Table of a Lie, of which only the third edition, Munich 1973, seems to have attained significant circulation. Eretz carries the case against the exterminations only slightly beyond Rassenyer. He depends heavily on Rassenyer in this respect, although he provides some new material. A major function of his book is the presentation of a remarkably bold and forthright general defense of the German nation. The unreasonable continuation of war crimes trials in West Germany, and the absence of any statute of limitations with respect to alleged war crimes by Germans, have had a seldomly remarked implication. People who were there have been afraid to come forward and report what, to their knowledge, actually happened. They would rather not call attention to the fact that they were there. However, it was inevitable that a few courageous individuals would come forward nevertheless. The most important of these, to date, has been Thies Christofferson, author of the booklet Die Auschwitz-Lüge, The Auschwitz Lie. Christofferson was at Auschwitz from January to December 1944. In 1973, he published his recollections and his firm view that no exterminations ever took place there. An English translation of Christofferson's booklet, to which some colorful announcements had been added, was published in 1974. Christofferson was followed by Dr. Wilhelm Staglich, a retired Hamburg judge, who had been assigned to an anti-aircraft unit near Auschwitz during 1944, and had visited the camp on a few occasions. For such honest reporting of his recollections, Staglich was punished with a 5-year, 20% reduction of his pension. In late 1973, Austin J. App, a retired English professor in Maryland, published a short booklet, The 6 Million Swindle. Early in 1974, Wolf Dieter Rota published the first volume of his study, Die Entlösung der Judenfrage, and later in 1974, Richard Harwood published in England his book, Did 6 Million Really Die? Harwood's booklet is quite good in convincing power, although it has some weak points, and the reader is referred to Rassenyer for a definitive treatment of the subject. It was favorably reviewed by Colin Wilson in the November 1974 issue of the influential British monthly Books and Bookmen, setting off a months-long controversy in the pages of that journal. In early 1975, Harry Elmer Barnes's translation of one of Rassenyer's books, The Drama of the European Jews, was issued by a small publisher in the United States.